You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, after a week of political gaffes, US-Israeli relations reach a new low. My guests today, Daniela Pellet and James Boyes, will be here to tell us why Washington and Jerusalem just can't see eye to eye. Later in the show, Al Jazeera journalist Ahmed Mansour has been freed after 2 days in a Berlin jail. But should he have been there in the first place? Then we'll be discussing the Confederate flag in the US and its significance in the wake of the recent shootings in Charleston. All that plus the latest on Greece's crunch time talks with the EU and why China wants fewer celebrities and more quality presenters on its TV screens. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Daniela Pellet, who's the editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Dr. James Boyes, a political historian and the author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to begin today with a quick roundup of the ongoing talks between Greece's finance minister and his counterparts in the Eurozone. No deal yet, but we are hearing that there may be light at the end of the tunnel by the end of the week. James, your reading on what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're in a highly fluid situation at the moment. There's a lot of ongoing situations. The last time we were hearing that there's a deal in place, that the creditors basically want this to get approved by the parliament before they put it in place, so they don't have any last-minute surprises, I think. And to be quite honest, if you're one of those creditors moving forward, I think that's a pretty reasonable stance to take.
Daniela, it does seem that the Greeks may have had to move on some of the things which seem to be unmovable. Only a few days ago, it said that they will make concessions on the rates of VAT. They have a three-tier system in Greece, which partly helps the islands in the Aegean, for example. And they're also going to make some moves on pension reform. Sellable when he goes back home?
Well, I think it's incredibly sensitive. I think the latest idea, I think, is to put the retirement age up to 67, which is a bit unfortunate for people reaching that that age, but something has to give somewhere. And I think on all sides, the costs are so high of a Grexit that it's very hard to contemplate what will happen, not just economically in the eventuality of Greece leaving the Eurozone, but also politically, also in terms of social structure and social cohesion in Greece and by extension, other countries in Europe.
James, just before we move on, what seems to be interesting is that, you know, there's, of course, we can look at Greece and say you've borrowed too much money and you've done things wrong and you've had terrible governments. But what happens is, you know, I was just reading yesterday that 100,000 of the key young Greek workers have left the country. So the more and more pressure you put on the country, the less likely it is it will ever get out of this kind of terrible kind of maelstrom of, you know, of just, you know, a shrinking economy, people having no hope. In the end, do you feel that, you know, maybe the Europeans have been a bit too brutal about some of this?
It's difficult, isn't it? You've got a brain drain, you've got a cash drain. I mean, the amount of money that was coming out of the banks over the last couple of days has been astronomical. So, you know, you could look at this and from a logical point of view, say the writing is on the wall here. I think what I would suggest is that there are so many pressures upon Greece from a European side of things to make sure they stay in so that the European project continues to work. I think if this was a purely applicable concept of logic, you know, should this continue as it is, the answer will be quite categorically no, but there's so many vested interests in all this. I think that they will keep having money thrown at it and thrown at it and thrown at it in an attempt just to make sure that the situation, the status quo prevails, even if that status quo is really not tenable in the long term.
Daniela, it's a bit of a precursor of what may happen in other countries that elect populist governments. The other thing that seems to come out of this is, you know, that, yeah, if you want to be a revolutionary, fine, you can go and run a revolution. But if you want to be a revolutionary that then kind of deals with the EU and goes through all the machinations, you have to do some boring legwork and you have to be nice and you have to kind of like learn how the diplomacy works. And Tsipras, you know, seems better, but certainly Varoufakis has in the end wound up so many people. You know, Juncker has turned against him. All these people that were sympathetic in the beginning, their negotiating tactics haven't quite, I think, worked in the way that I think they thought they had a piece of logic to go to the EU with that would win over, and it just hasn't happened.
It's the age-old question, isn't it, of you come into politics with either dogma or ideology and you have to make some inevitable compromises. The risks, though, as I said, are much greater. If this fails, then it opens the way in Greece for much, you know, for the right-wing political groups, which have been energised by the crisis, and not just in Greece, but all over Europe. I mean, even in the UK, the parties which are talking about leaving Europe have got a distinctly xenophobic slant to it. So I think that is really the issue, that if you move the goalposts from a sort of sensible approach to Europe, you end up with something really which is just out of the consensus.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I'm sure there's going to be much more on that story over the week. But next we're going to look at US-Israeli relations, which are in a fairly disastrous stage at the moment. The special relationship between the two nations has been frostier than usual because of the relationship growing between the US and Iran as they negotiate a deal there. Now, a new book by former Israeli ambassador to the US, Michael Oren, is making things even worse, accusing Obama of abandoning the core principles of the two nations' partnership. And then there were more ructions at the weekend, which we will dive into. Has that special relationship completely vanished, do you think, Danielle?
Well, it hasn't completely vanished because they have strategic interests which are fairly unshakable in terms of intelligence sharing and so on and so forth and economic ties. But really, diplomatically, we're plumbing depth after depth after depth. And Netanyahu has never had a good record of getting on well with the White House in any of his previous administrations. But this is really quite ludicrous. You have a former ambassador, Mr. Oren, talking about Obama's relationship with the Arab world being influenced by the fact he was abandoned by two Muslim fathers. I mean, this is just ludicrous language, ludicrous argument for a supposed diplomat to be using. It's highly embarrassing. It's kind of like one of those really embarrassing family spats that just spirals out of control at a wedding.
And on the Israeli side, there seems to be some, we mustn't overplay this, but there do seem to be some hints of racism at play when they deal with Obama. Their perception of him as a black man and as a man who has a name that makes him sound like Muslim to many people, which he is not, of course. But at the weekend, Judy Shalom Neer Moses is the wife of a senior Israeli politician. She told a really stupid, bland, annoying, racist joke on Twitter, which people dived in immediately and said, "What are you up to?" And she has got a bit of a record for kind of ruffling feathers. But it's terrible that, you know, a senior politician's wife in the Israeli government feels, you know, actually this is fine kind of fodder to be racist about Obama. And do you feel that there's, I don't know, for the White House, James, it must just feel like they're sometimes dealing with hicks from the sticks. The lack of, you know, again, negotiating tactics, understanding what each other wants, it's gone horribly wrong.
Well, I think we're going to talk more about hicks and the sticks in a little bit later on, quite frankly. But I think you're absolutely right. One thing I will say, I mean, with Twitter, it's far too easily done. You put something down, you're stupid, and you hit send and it's gone forever and it's out there. I'm sure there's a lot of people who put stuff up they deeply regret, but there's no doubt about it. This is indefensible. And as you say, coming from the wife of a senior Israeli politician. It's funny, though, that we're talking about the breakdown in US-Israeli relations and how poor this is. You know, not that long ago, there was all talk about the fact that the US is too close to Israel, that there is far too, that you couldn't criticize Israel, for example, from an American point of view. So it does swing around, I guess. There's no doubt about it, as Daniela rightly pointed out, that Netanyahu has got a very, very poor track record of dealing with anybody of any political perspective in the White House, be the Democrat or Republican. Certainly, the era I look at with Bill Clinton, for example, there's a very poor relationship at that point. There's no doubt, I think, if you look forward once Obama is out of the White House, I think there is a hope on both sides within the vested interests that things can only get better, be that under President Hillary Clinton or potentially Jeb Bush, I would have thought.
Daniel was saying, obviously, a lot of this comes from the fact that, you know, the Americans are speaking to the Iranians, trying to get a nuclear deal that seems like it may happen. Now, that has meant that, you know, Israel isn't very happy about it. The Saudis aren't very happy about it. But do you think that in a way that America is indifferent to, you know, the harumphing from Jerusalem? Because in the end, it feels that its kind of sway with Jerusalem doesn't really matter. They'd like to see a peace deal. They'd like to see something, you know, on the table. It would be a capping moment for the Obama administration to have brought peace to the Middle East, you know, for there to be a settlement for the Palestinians. And that just doesn't seem ever likely to happen in another generation even. So in a way, if they can't get that, they might as well go after other deals, just try and sort other problems in the Middle East. And it doesn't really matter if it upsets the Israelis.
It's very hard to imagine a deal that America, the West, could make with Iran that would satisfy Netanyahu. That's clear. But he isn't the only voice in Israel. Plenty of very senior security officials and strategic analysts support the deal and say that, you know, military action is not on the table. I mean, one of the issues that Netanyahu fought his election campaign on, though, was that he is the only Israeli leader that can talk tough and stand up to Washington. He's that much of an operator. I mean, that was quite the explicit part of some of his campaign broadcasts. And this is, you know, dealing with his personal brand, that he is the protector of Israel. He knows better than anyone else what needs to be done. And so you can frame any foreign policy decision, even if it seems to be a ridiculous inversion of the usual relationship with America, Israel's most important strategic ally. He can frame it as actually he's standing up for the interests of the people. I wouldn't, as you said, put too much store in what Judy Neer Moses said about Obama, because although many Israelis are suspicious that the Washington right now has got Israel's best interests in heart, she's kind of a media celebrity. You know, she's not indicative. Her next tweet was, I think she was tweeting her husband in public, going, "Oh dear."
James, you've obviously watched the world of the Clintons very carefully, and you know, it's fine if you have one of these spats and you think you can sit it out and there'll be a change of an administration and somebody else will come in who will have different thoughts about your leadership or your country. But for Israel, there's a good chance that they'll be dealing with Hillary Clinton next. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem to be cut from that different cloth, do you think, from Obama, or is she?
I would completely disagree, to be quite honest. I think one of the great issues with this administration, which far too few people have really been inclined to investigate, is Barack Obama's personal inability to develop good, strong working relationships with anyone, both friend or foe. We saw the past weekend his deteriorating relationship with Nancy Pelosi, of course, a very senior member of the Democratic Party, going against the president on a trade issue. He hasn't developed a good, strong working relationship with any key foreign leaders, be that domestically or foreign. And this has played into a great problem for him. He cannot get working consensus to get an awful lot of things completed, either home or overseas. There's no doubt about it that the Israelis are, from their point of view, rightly concerned about any deal with the Iranians. But I think, and I'm certainly not trying to put words in Danielle's mouth, I think I'm kind of paraphrasing a little bit what she said, is ultimately Israel has got nowhere else to go. They're not going to end up coming away from the United States. And the Obama administration sees going hand in hand with the Cuban deal an opportunity for greatness, I think, and putting an end to 30, 35 years of hostility with the Iranians. And the Israelis, I think, are concerned that Obama is going to put that idea of a legacy issue ahead of Israeli national security. And from Netanyahu's point of view, he can't allow that to happen.
Daniela.
Well, I mean, I think Obama has been a terrible, terrible disappointment in many areas, especially foreign policy. But with Israel-Palestine, he hasn't really been left a lot of room to manoeuvre. And I can't really blame him too much for that. Certainly, if he thinks that the Iranian deal, is going to be his legacy, then I think he's a little bit, it would be super naive to think so. I mean, I support the deal. I think the deal is the best that can be achieved at the moment. But in terms of ending the hostilities between the two countries that have been going on for 30, 35 years, especially with everything else that is going on right now in the region, with Syria, with the Gulf states, I think that's slightly unlikely.
But for both of you, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, that, you know, we've had elections recently. It's not like the public opinion in Israel is like angered at Netanyahu's dealing with the Americans. They seem to put up with it. They vote for him still.
A lot of people voted for him. A lot of people didn't. He managed to play on people's fears. You know, he's very good at raising that. And as I said, he puts himself forward as a leader. I mean, a lot of people, polls have shown that a lot of people, even though they find his politics pretty unattractive, they see as a leader, as the Prime Minister of Israel, they trust him more than the alternative.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Daniela Pellet and James Boyes. Coming up next, we will hear the latest on the imprisonment and release of the Al Jazeera journalist Ahmed Mansour and ask why the Confederate flag is raising renewed concerns in the US.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, The Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, The Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is James Boyes and also Daniela Pellet. Now, Ahmed Mansour, a prominent journalist for Al Jazeera, was arrested in Berlin at the weekend and has only just been released in the past few hours. He was held on request of Egypt due to his supposed involvement in promoting the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood in that country and his alleged involvement in torturing a lawyer in Tahrir Square in 2011. Mansour has been released without charge, and the charges came from a country with a shaky record on human rights, especially when dealing with journalists. So should he have been arrested at all? Daniela?
No. In short.
Should we move on?
This is. I mean, he was not just only arrested, but held for 2 days. This is really embarrassing for the Germans. There was unanimous condemnation from the German parliament, from journalism institutions. There was all kinds of snide comments made trying to link this with Sisi's recent visit to Germany and the multi-billion dollar deal that Siemens made with Egypt. The whole thing is an incredible mess. I have no idea how this how it happened. Really, really embarrassing.
James, for Al Jazeera, you know, they've got their man out and it's been only a couple of days, but they've been through this, you know, this terrible situation in Egypt where three of their people were held for a very long time. Do you think it makes, you know, Al Jazeera concerned about where it sends its journalists around the world, or should it make them concerned?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, let's not forget, we're talking about Germany and Egypt here, but it wasn't that long ago that I remember Al Jazeera journalists getting beaten up and kicked out of a bar in Denver, Colorado, when they went over there to cover American elections during a presidential election. So there is a perception of Al Jazeera, I think, which is misplaced in certain countries. There's no doubt about it. They'll be very relieved to have this chap out after the prolonged situation with their reporters in Egypt. But it's absolutely a terrible situation. I mean, quite what on earth the German authorities are doing, responding to an Egyptian request like this, is anybody's guess, quite frankly.
Now, we can all agree that he should not have been arrested, I think. But, Daniela, what's intriguing is it happens a little bit because the line is not clear-cut between, you know, what is a journalistic organisation and how the writ of the royal family in Qatar runs into Al Jazeera. And if they had a better separation, if it was held in a trust, if it was very clear that, you know, there was money and funding, but there was no writ whatsoever, then perhaps these people would be safer on the ground. Is it time for, you know, the Qataris also to look at how that is used? Because, you know, obviously, like many countries, they use it as a bit of a soft power tool to get their views across. Is it time for a bit of a rethink there as well, though?
Well, if it was rethought, then it wouldn't be such an effective soft power tool. I mean, it has been extraordinarily effective. It's really, really reshaped the landscape of Arabic language media and its offshoots in English and so on. It's true, though, that Al Jazeera is used as a tool of foreign policy by the Qataris. And although I would absolutely not support the jailing of journalists on such trumped up charges, they're not. They've made quite a propaganda coup out of this particular issue and what happened in Egypt previously. But the interest and the reason for Al Jazeera is not to have free and fair journalism, and they do a lot of great journalism. But that's not their raison d'être. The raison d'être is as a soft power tool for Qatar, and as that they are successful. And I don't see any possibility that they would take steps to make the journalism better and the soft power less effective.
It's fascinating, James, because, you know, it is a very successful TV station. You know, when you at its best, when you watch it, you know, they've got somebody in Chad the minute something happens. They've got someone in Guinea. They have a huge network of correspondents. So, you know, they're telling good stories and interesting stories that you really do not see on other medium. But this idea of it being a BBC for the, you know, for Qatar, it's not quite that. It is more you do sense a bit of an agenda in the stories they choose to tell.
I think we perhaps need to be a little bit cautious here and distinguish perhaps between Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera America, and Al Jazeera English, which operate very, very differently editorially, certainly. And I've done a lot of work with Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera America, and have never felt any request or pressure to toe a certain line. When they launched in the US and in the UK, they hired some very, very high profile, very successful award-winning journalists from the UK and from the United States. I don't think any of them would have worked there if they felt that there was an editorial pressure in that section. Now, if we move to the straight Al Jazeera broadcast come out of Qatar in Arabic, that might be a very, very different situation. I understand that it probably is. But they are, I think, attempting to establish a global brand that is closer to a CNN stroke BBC effort. But clearly, there is a domestic element working out of Qatar that very much sees it as a soft power tool and very much as the voice of the government. But I think that operates slightly differently once you get out of the specific region.
Now, we're going to move on now to Charleston, South Carolina. Among the mourning for victims of the mass shooting in a local church last week, there's also been anger and demonstrations about the flying of the Confederate battle flag that is above state institutions such as the Capitol building in Columbia. The flag is an emblem of the South and such is seen by many as having implicit links with the era of slavery. The meanings of flags can, of course, evolve over time, and even the UK's own Union Jack has been tarred at certain points in its history. Daniela, should they take the flag down?
Well, this particular flag has been super contentious. And as I understand it, Republicans and Democrats and presidential candidates are all saying, well, this is not really the time. I mean, this is not really appropriate to have it flying right now. I think it's hard for a Brit to really understand the sensitivities over these kind of flags, because we aren't nationalistic in this way. I remember the first time I went to America, I was really taken aback to see American flags flying in people's front yards, because in England that's making a serious statement of what, I'm not quite sure. But it also speaks to another issue, which is how do you memorialise a nation's history when they have two very different narratives? Do you say that everything, all the symbols of the South are null and void because it's so caught up with slavery? Or do you allow some part of that culture and that history, is that some part of it acceptable? You can't really just erase an enormous section of what to many people there is part of their personal and family history.
James, this is a flag that does have, mm-hmm. you know, tough connotations for many, many people. But I think, as Daniel was saying, it also for many people is a symbol of difference, that we are the South, we're not the North, you know, and the South, you know, lost, you know, the Civil War. It feels it's holding on to some form of identity even now. And the South is different to the North. It has held on to emblems, which still sum up a different way of life, which isn't all about race as well, which is often just to do about a kind of an attitude about life. And, you know, the Southern gentleman still survives. So should they be allowed to use this flag and just kind of, you know, by accepting its troubled history, give it a new lease of life?
There's a simple reason why that flag would be allowed to continue to be flown, and that's the First Amendment, which is freedom of speech. Many people might find it offensive, but the American system of government, the very constitution that governs the land at the highest level, maintains the right to say and fly the flag without any impediment. It's important to recognize this is not a left-right issue. A lot of people, I think, in Europe are very quick to say, well, this is going to be defended by Republicans and attacked by Democrats. Mitt Romney, for example, has come out and said it should be we should stop flying it. Lindsey Graham, who is a candidate this year's presidential campaign, has said, no, we should keep it going. There's going to be an awful lot of to-ing and fro-ing. The Republican Party have got a big problem on their hands here. If they are seen to come out and attack the Southern traditions, the flying of the Confederate flag, they're going to have a huge problem. And it's important to remember, the South Carolina votes very, very early in the primary season. Someone like Jeb Bush has got a major dilemma here. He might not do quite as well as he would like in the first northern primaries in New Hampshire and Iowa. He needs to do very, very well in South Carolina. So he cannot possibly afford to alienate any voters in that part of the world. So he's got a very tough dance on his hands in the next couple of days.
I think Jeb Bush has kind of enigmatically said he's sure they will do the right thing. But what that right thing is, he's very unwilling to say. Just before we move to the final story, interesting, Daniel, here in the UK in the 1970s, the National Front adopted the Union Jack. It became very much a flag of the right. But now as the Union here begins to fall apart, the Union Jack has become a bit of a symbol of comfort for many English people. They the flag of St George even, but they've clung on to that flag, and it's had a different, a bit of a renaissance, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's been very successfully reclaimed. I mean, we've had a good 2 or 3 years of very jolly patriotism with the Olympics, with the royal baby, 2 royal babies now. And this, Republican as I am, this has kind of proved to be a unifying force for Britain. And the Union Jack is now seen on cupcakes and tea towels and, you know, any kind of unpleasant connotations, I think, have been completely taken away.
Now, seeing as you're both star turns, maybe a bit worried about the final story, because China's media regulator has banned celebrities from appearing as presenters on TV shows. The aim is to ensure no improper remarks are made while on air. According to the Xinhua news agency, television hosts must have proper vocational qualifications from now on, and they will be checked by the authorities. What else is going on here, Daniel? And do you think this is a good idea?
I think I'd be quite happy not to see Stephen Fry never presenting another another show on the BBC, but I'm not quite sure what vocational qualifications look like.
And James, what's your
yeah,
take?
I think we agree. Let's banish Stephen Fry, quite frankly.
Poor Stephen Fry, why is he getting in the next?
Everywhere, isn't he, quite frankly?
But why is it, do you think, the Chinese are so concerned about it? Is there a sense that they're worried that these people have too much sway, and if they say the wrong thing, or these people are just too much of loose cannons if you're a celebrity?
Well, look, there's no point being an authoritarian state unless you can exert your authority. And this is a great opportunity.
James, you know, I'm not sure that you've been watching CCTV, the Chinese equivalent of Al Jazeera.
But I haven't. It's very good.
Is it?
Very impressive.
As a good competitor to Al Jazeera?
Perhaps not quite in the same
league. They don't pay as well.
No, it doesn't have the same sort of exciting breadth of scope, but it's pretty polished.
James, does that have interest? Do you jump across the channels when you're, sure you're at home
absolutely.
With it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to get a... it's also... if you watch the same channel, you're going to get the same take. And it's a great problem. I was trying to channel surf to see what's going on there across the various spectrums. And one of the great problems you have, again, I do a lot of work covering the States, obviously, is that you end up with echo chambers. So you end up with the same people only watching the same channels, a certain dynamic only watch CNBC, a certain channel only dynamic only watch Fox. So you end up getting your own views channeled back at you if you're not careful. And this becomes self-perpetuating. So I think it's the job of any self-informed individual to try and find as many different takes as possible. And the news channels obviously a good way of doing that.
Well, here, Monica, we often have France van Kassel in the background. Then I see Russia Today, all sorts of things unfolding. And you certainly get a variety of perspectives, as you do here on Midori House. But that's all we have time for today. My thanks to Daniela Pellard and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Elena Nikolacheva and also by Tamor Haveda Williams. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you for listening.